From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, breakaway unrest. Regions in eastern Ukraine turn to Russia following regional referendums branded illegal by the US and Europe.
The so-called referenda are illegal under Ukrainian law and a transparent attempt to create further division and disorder.
Also today, Vermont becomes the first US state to mandate labeling of genetically modified foods. And Boko Haram release a video claiming to show the missing schoolgirls abducted by the extremists weeks ago.
We have no reason to question its authenticity. Our intelligence experts are combing through every detail of the video for clues that might help in ongoing efforts to secure the release of the girls.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. In a newly released video, the leader of the extremist group Boko Haram has offered to trade some of the more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls he's kidnapped in exchange for members of his terrorist organization currently held in prison. In the video, over 100 of the girls are shown wearing long dress, forced to recite passages of the Quran, saying they've converted to Islam from Christianity. Boko Haram leader Abu Bakr Shekau says the offer to trade hostages only applies for the schoolgirls who have refused to convert. In the U.S., State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki emphasized that while the Nigerian government will make the final decision, the U.S. government is not in favor of this proposal.
The United States policy, I should say, is to deny kidnappers the benefits of their criminal acts, including ransoms or concessions.
Meanwhile, an Israeli counterterrorism team is on its way to Nigeria to join U.S. and U.K. teams in the hunt for the missing girls. Pro-Moscow separatists are calling on Russia to absorb Ukraine's eastern region of Donetsk after claiming victory in a referendum on self-rule. The head of the self-proclaimed People's Republic of Donetsk, Denis Pushilin, also said the separatists may need Russia's help if they can't repel the Ukrainian army's attacks. The U.S. and EU have called the independence vote over the weekend in Donetsk illegal. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Denis Pushilin said the request to join Russia is to be sent in writing to the Russian President Vladimir Putin. At a press conference held after the final count of ballots cast during the independence referendum on Sunday, Mr. Pushilin said this step is seen as a way to resolve the political deadlock. He added the rebel forces will try to push the government's troops away from the region, yet if they fail to do so independently, Russia's help may be needed. The Kyiv authorities said the referendum was orchestrated by Russia and is an attempt to overthrow legitimate state power in Ukraine.
South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius, accused of murder, may be sent for psychiatric observation. A forensic psychiatrist called as a defense witness told the court that the athlete suffers from a general anxiety disorder brought about by the amputation of his legs as a baby. Pistorius has maintained he accidentally shot and killed his girlfriend Riva Steenkamp behind a bathroom door last year. From FSN's Bureau in South Africa, Gary Alfonso reports.
The dramatic testimony from forensic psychiatrist Merrill Foster that Pistorius suffered from general anxiety disorder turned legal proceedings upside down in court. State prosecutor Gerinel told the judge the finding meant the defense was introducing the possibility of diminished mental capacity and argued Pistorius should be committed for psychiatric observation.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
The billionaire owner of the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team has apologized for making racist comments during a private recorded phone call.
But Donald Sterling says he feels he was baited into making the comments by his girlfriend, who's at the center of the controversy. Military and security officials say that a suspected U.S. drone strike in Yemen has killed six Al-Qaeda militants. The drone reportedly hit a car in which the militants were traveling. Local media say they were members of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Here's our Washington correspondent, Lorna Shattuck.
This drone strike comes as the Yemeni military, trained by the U.S., continues an offensive against Al-Qaeda, an operation which it says has already killed dozens of leaders and regained control of several major towns. Militants have increased their own attacks on Western interests in retaliation. Last week, the U.S. temporarily suspended operations at its embassy in the capital, Sana'a, because of security concerns. On Friday, it was also revealed that an American commando and CIA officer shot and killed two Yemenis who were trying to kidnap them in a barbershop in late April. The U.S. has been carrying out a heavy drone strike campaign in the country, sparking anger over civilian casualties.
And U.S. authorities have approved the use of a new robotic arm with fine motor skills. The limb was developed by a U.S. defense research team, with hopes that Army veterans can help test the prosthetic's capabilities. The groundbreaking prosthetic has been 8 years in the making. A video from the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency shows a man using the arm to carefully move eggs, a task requiring a delicate touch. The new limb is known as the DECA arm and is part of a larger $100 million revolutionizing prosthetics project. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Pro-Moscow separatists are calling on Russia to absorb the eastern region of Donetsk after claiming victory in a referendum on self-rule for eastern Ukraine. The Obama administration and European Union had already said they would not recognise the vote, dismissing it as illegal. Moscow greeted the results with calls for dialogue and peaceful implementation. Some of the organisers in the region say nearly 90% voted in favour. Journalist with The Washington Post, Simon Denyer, is in Ukraine and watched the ballot unfold.
They encouraged people to come out and vote. They said that the vote wasn't about joining Russia or independence. They were kind of specifically vague about it. And so people came out and voted in quite large numbers. A lot of people said to us they were voting against the government in Kiev, against fascism as they see it in the Kiev government. They were voting against the violence which has happened in Ukraine, which they blame on the Kiev government. Some people wanted more autonomy for this region. Some people wanted independence. Some people wanted to join Russia. But the fact is, the referendum itself was a sham in terms of its credibility, in terms of the way it was done. But it did reflect the will of people here, that they're angry with the government in Kiev. So a lot of people did turn out to vote.
Sunday's referendum, is that being viewed as a stepping stone to something more concrete?
But after saying this wasn't a vote about joining Russia, the separatists here in Donetsk say they are going to ask Russia if they can join Russia. So they literally were obfuscating about this question before the referendum. People turned out and voted not being asked to join Russia. And the separatists have now turned around and said, well, actually, this region is historically part of Russia. This belongs with Russia. We're asking Russia to absorb us.
Simon, you were there. You witnessed this ballot go ahead. Was it one that went through without much incident and controversy? What did you witness?
Well, I wouldn't set much store behind the exact results. I mean, we saw people coming to polling stations with multiple passports and picking up multiple papers and filling out multiple ballot papers. We asked people, what are you doing? And someone said, well, it's for my elderly relatives. They can't, my mother and father, they can't come today, but they gave me their passports. Someone else said she was filling one out for her husband who couldn't make it. So, it wasn't exactly a referendum based on credible electoral practices. There were urns, kept in closed rooms next to stacks of unfilled ballot papers. So, anybody could have just filled one out and plunked a few more in. The election was, entirely carried out by the separatists themselves. So I don't think it has no sort of legal credibility. I mean, obviously it has no legal credibility within Ukraine anyway, but the actual results have no sort of formal credibility either. But having said that, foreign correspondents, a bunch of us, did our own straw poll of just public opinion, on the streets of Donetsk, away from the referendum. And we found that most people were intending to vote or had voted, and that most people favoured a yes vote. Between us, we asked 186 people that. Just a straw poll. But definitely you get a feeling that, well, we can't trust the actual results, an awful lot of people did turn out, and an awful lot of people did vote in favour of the referendum question, which was something we can translate vaguely as self-determination or self-rule or sovereignty or even independence.
Simon Denyer in eastern Ukraine. Now, following that controversial referendum, the EU has broadened a list of travel bans and asset freezes against 13 people and two companies. European foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday say Russia is to blame for supporting separatist movements and have threatened wider measures if Moscow intervenes in Ukraine's upcoming presidential elections. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
After two separate elections in East Ukraine over the weekend saw regions claim independence, EU foreign ministers in Brussels expanded their blacklist of officials they say helped to stage the illegal referenda. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton.
Because of the situation in Crimea and the deterioration of the situation in other parts of Ukraine, we expanded the sanctions criteria and decided to add 13 individuals to the list of those subject to an asset ban and travel ban. That brings the total to 61.
Also on the list are two energy companies in Crimea that last March saw a similar wave of separatist stage elections to join Russia. The UK's Foreign Secretary William Hague says neither the Crimean vote nor subsequent referenda in East Ukraine can be recognised.
These votes, these attempts at referendums have zero credibility in the eyes of the world. They are illegal by anybody's standards. They don't meet any standard, not a single standard of objectivity, transparency, fairness, or being properly conducted.
Moscow denies it's seeking to annex Ukraine's eastern regions or that it's supporting separatists there. Sweden's foreign minister Carl Bildt, though, is skeptical.
I think it would be difficult for President Putin to say that he doesn't have control over the Russian forces. And we also saw, by the way, that some persons in eastern Ukraine that we know are very closely tied into Moscow were very active in the so-called referendum. You have to judge Moscow less by the words and more by the actions.
But it was Moscow's endorsement of Sunday's election results that pushed the EU to issue a horizon for moving to so-called Phase 3 economic sanctions. That will depend on whether Russia is seen as a helpful partner in staging Ukraine's first elections since the crisis set for May 25th. It's the closest the EU has come to issuing a red line for Moscow, though Sweden's Carl Bildt hesitated to put it quite that way.
Red lines are on the other side of the Atlantic. They are the ones that are in the business of red line. I'm not quite certain that we are. We are in the business of trying to help Ukraine develop its democracy, preserves its territorial integrity, reforming its economy after decades of corruption and mismanagement. These are huge tasks that are going to be dominating the next few years.
But immediate concerns like the uncertain future of residents in breakaway Ukrainian regions will continue to dominate, with the prospect of Russian support to those communities keeping tension between Moscow and the West worryingly high. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
This is FSN Reports. Sound from a video claiming to show some of the 276 schoolgirls who've been missing since they were kidnapped in Nigeria several weeks ago. The footage released by the Islamist group Boko Haram shows young women wearing traditional Muslim headscarves chanting a prayer. Speaking on Monday, US State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said the United States, which has already sent advisers to help with the hunt for the missing girls, is now analysing the footage.
We have no reason to question its authenticity. Our intelligence experts are combing through every detail of the video for clues that might help in ongoing efforts to secure the release of the girls.
In the video, the group's leader says the teens have converted to Islam and will be held hostage until a deal is struck with the Nigerian government to release imprisoned militants. William Wallace is reporting the story for the Financial Times from Abuja, and Javier Blas is the paper's Africa editor. They spoke to the FT's Ben Hall.
Well, according to security officials here, the military has followed multiple leads in their attempt to find the girls. This has been complicated, however, by the fact that some villages in that area, large parts of which are effectively ungoverned, have been infiltrated by Boko Haram. And in other villages, people are too terrified of reprisals to collaborate with the authorities. So the search has been hampered partly by that. It's also been hampered by huge amounts of confusion about how many girls were taken, how they were able to be taken. But clearly, at the very outset, the military was slow to respond, although some soldiers in the area reportedly did put up something of a fight before the gunmen were able to get to the school.
Javier, if I come to you, Boko Haram is not the only Islamist militant group in Africa, but it certainly seems the most bloodthirsty. Is this now the biggest threat to regional peace?
Certainly is the biggest threat that Nigeria is suffering. But if we look at Boko Haram, all the attacks have been so far very much concentrated in this remote area of northeast Nigeria that William is describing. They have not been able to attack Abuja, the capital, in 2 years. Indeed, the recent bombing was the first time that it happened really since 2012. So at the moment and so far has been very much a national problem. We are not talking here about the risk of Al-Shabaab in the eastern part of Africa, where has been able to attack multiple countries with attacks in Nairobi, Kenya, Uganda, Somalia, and threats also into Tanzania. And neither is able to mount the attacks that we have seen from Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, where we have seen attacks from Mali to also Algeria, and potentially also being involved in Libya. So far, Boko Haram has been mostly a local problem for Nigerian authorities. I'm very much targeting Nigerian targets rather than international targets. There have been some incidents involving also international targets. So I would not say that is the biggest threat for peace and stability in the region, but certainly they are grabbing the attention with very spectacular attacks, grabbing the headlines and really hitting in a moment where there was a lot of international attention for a good reason into Nigeria.
William, what sort of help does Nigeria actually need in terms of dealing with this problem?
I think initially the satellites will be very helpful to them. In terms of dealing with the problem of finding the girls, I think it's very difficult. There are two different versions, or there are many versions, I should say, of whether they actually know where some of them are. And in one version, it suggests that actually they're very reluctant to storm the area because they fear that the group could actually massacre the girls. So they're being very cautious. But then there are other accounts coming also from official sources that suggest they really don't have an idea of their exact location. So any of this logistical help that could help them track the girls could also, at a later stage in a bigger strategic fight against Boko Haram, be useful in tracking the group and its whereabouts in what is a very remote place. There is also some talk now that drones could be provided for Nigeria in their fight against Boko Haram.
So is it a lack of means from the Nigerian government or a lack of kind of will to really tackle this problem?
Well, if you look over the past year since the government declared a state of emergency in the three worst affected northeastern provinces and also sent a military surge in there, it was clear at the beginning that Boko Haram had been put on the back foot. It was largely driven out of urban areas. And one of the reasons for these brutal attacks on rural and village areas is because they were driven out of urban spaces. So they were initially very successful. I think what you've seen in the last few months is the group hitting back at softer targets, partly because they were under pressure. But there are a significant number of Boko Haram extremists. Some official estimates here suggest as many as 5,000. And the Nigerian army is extremely stretched. It has soldiers deployed in around 25 of the 36 states in the Federation, policing the peace. And so the troop numbers that they have there may be inadequate, given that it's a vast space and very difficult to operate in.
And to what extent do you think the insurgency, if you like, is actually born out of religious grievances or interreligious conflict in Nigeria and socioeconomic factors, lack of jobs and opportunity that will last for decades and will therefore perpetuate the problem?
Well, actually, if you look over history, there is a long track record of charismatic preachers carrying an extreme message and developing a significant following in that part of Nigeria. And so this is very much not the first time that something like this has happened. I think the Boko Haram group grew out of one charismatic preacher who was killed, in fact, in 2009 whilst in custody. And his successor has taken a much more violent approach to his attempts to carve out an Islamic caliphate, if you like, in part of Nigeria. There is also the fact that over the past 15 years or so, the southern part of Nigeria, or at least pockets of it, have developed much faster, and you're seeing relative prosperity coming to those parts of the country which have benefited much more from liberal market reforms. And in parallel, the north, which was very much state-supported in the past, where you had big industry that was state-subsidized, has been in very sharp economic decline. And clearly that does provide something of a propitious climate for extremism.
Javier, to what extent do you think Nigeria's reputation has been tarnished?
Certainly, Nigeria is missing an opportunity for projecting the good image that they wanted. It was used by a very careful plan by the government. Only a few weeks ago, Nigeria, with the support of international partners, including the International Monetary Fund, announced a revision of his statistics that revealed that his GDP was significantly higher than we thought, and indeed the largest in Africa, well above South Africa. Then the great and good of Africa was descending into Abuja for the Davos of Africa, the World Economic Forum, where the country was going to showcase his economic strength as an investment destination. Certainly, these news are bad for the reputation of Nigeria, particularly the handling and the way it has been handled in public has not been the best one. But if you look at the long term, it's still 170, 175 million people, economy growing at 7% every year. That means that the size of the Nigerian economy doubles every decade. So it's still an area that is going to attract international investors. The area where the violence has been focused so far in the northeast, and if the Nigerian authorities are able to contain Boko Haram into the three northeastern states, I think that the economy of the rest of the country could continue. The main problem is we will continue having these imbalances with the north doesn't develop and the south continue to develop. But there is a tradition of emerging markets, including India. In some cases, you could even find a situation in China with Tibet and in some areas of Latin America, particularly, let's remember Colombia with the drug problem, or Mexico with the drug problem, where internal conflict and insurgency happen at the very same time that economic growth goes very fast and indeed international investors continue going into the country. But it doesn't make any favors to Nigeria what is happening.
Javier Blas, Africa editor of the Financial Times, and William Wallace, who's reporting the story for the paper from Nigeria. They were talking to Ben Hall. And you can find lots more reporting like that on the paper's website, ft.com. This is FSN Reports. This week, the state of Vermont became the first in the US to require the labelling of genetically modified organisms, known as GMOs for short. California, Washington and other states have tried and failed to pass similar laws, and this one is expected to be challenged in court by food corporations. In Washington, our correspondent Alice Olstein spoke with Dave Murphy, the executive director of the group Food Democracy Now, about what this development means for food producers and consumers in the United States.
Vermont's law basically was written to conform really to the European standard. It would label genetically engineered foods, but trace amounts would be 0.9% or less, which allows for contamination, inadvertent contamination of an organic or a non-GMO grain. And basically, that can happen in the marketplace no matter what, but it would be no fault of the farmers and no fault of the manufacturers, typically. And also, a threshold of 0.9% allows companies to test and meet that threshold. Anything above 0.9% would have a label, this product contains genetically engineered ingredients, this product has been genetically engineered.
And why do you think Vermont succeeded in this effort where states like California and Washington State failed?
It's a really big difference between California and Washington State. Were both ballot initiatives. And in California, it was a citizens-led ballot initiative where voters have a direct vote at the ballot box. So on election day, they go to the ballot box to vote in favor or against mandatory labeling. So in California, the opposition, led by the Grocery Manufacturers Association of Monsanto, spent $46 million to deceive California voters. That ballot initiative lost by 48.6% to 51.4%. Last year in Washington State, the opposition spent $22 million. It's a very different process in a legislative thing. You have to go through elected officials. And so in Vermont and Connecticut and Maine, there were very strong grassroots coalitions encouraging their elected officials to vote in favor of mandatory labeling. So I think really the difference is that in Connecticut and Maine and in Vermont, the opposition could not spend an endless barrage of money to confuse voters.
And you mentioned the standards in Europe. What can we learn from their experiences, both in terms of safety and how the farmers deal with it, how the stores deal with it, et cetera?
It's four words, five words in a package. 64 other countries around the world already label all their products that are genetically engineered. All of Europe, Russia, China, Syria, South Africa. Monsanto, the biotech industry, and the Grocery Manufacturers Association have said, junk food companies, this would cause an inordinate rise in food costs. But the facts have not borne that out. In the European Union, when mandatory labeling went into effect in the early 2000s, food costs did not go up one dime. And studies have shown, independent studies have regularly shown that there'd be no increase in food costs. It's really a simple label. The real problem is that the chemical companies and biotech companies like Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta, they're the ones that are terrified of a label because they believe it would decrease the amount of crops sold in the farmers here in the U.S. The fact is, you know, in America, our basic democratic rights should not be stymied or halted because corporations fear how consumers are going to respond in a free market.
There have been unsuccessful attempts on the federal level to bring some sort of labeling initiative into law, including in the most recent farm bill that wasn't successful. What's going on there, and what are groups like yours trying to do?
3 weeks ago, a congressman from Kansas, Mike Pompeo, is a Republican. He introduced a piece of legislation that would have called for voluntary labeling of genetically engineered foods. It would have made it illegal for states to pass a GMO labeling bill. Basically, it would preempt states' rights to pass a bill. It would not allow mandatory labeling. It would allow products that contain the word natural on their box to include genetically engineered ingredients. I don't know. I've never talked to anyone out there, unless they're associated with some kind of food and manufacturing industry, that thinks that genetically engineered foods are natural. When you hear the word natural, you think that it was made in nature. And definitively, genetically engineered products that have had artificial DNA inserted into their cellular structure in a lab by no means should ever contain genetically engineered ingredients and be called natural.
So what's next for your organization and others that are working on this issue?
We have other bills in other states. 26 states have legislation this year. New York State passed a bill out of the Commerce Committee last week. It's getting ready to go into another committee and could be voted on the Senate floor. Another bill is in Massachusetts, waiting for a vote, as is a bill in New Hampshire and Rhode Island. So also, there's ballot initiatives that are going to be fought in Colorado and in Oregon this year. So we understand that the Grocery Manufacturers Association is going to sue the state of Vermont. We're going to make sure we have an insurance policy where Colorado and Oregon are going to win mandatory labeling. So this may end up in a court, but it's actually, we're taking the conversation and we're not backing down. We welcome this fight in the public realm.
Dave Murphy, the executive director of the group Food Democracy Now. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Tuesday, why Nintendo has had to apologise over a same-sex slip-up. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.